We're going to cover 14 through the end. I guess everybody's gone to the deer lease to get it ready. What's going on? Maybe deer dove season?
Archery Saturday.
I don't know what the practicing tonight. Yeah, Wednesday night practice. Okay. Well, I don't know what's going on. Sunday was a little, we had a lot of guests Sunday. And a lot of people were gone. So I know where most of that group over there on that side was. But I don't know what's happening up here. Okay. Let's finish 2:14 through the end of 2, and then we'll dive off into the one where you have your study guide, Integrity in a Tight Spot. But we'll start now with 2:14 and finish this little section. And at mealtime, Boaz said to her, to Ruth, "Come here and eat some bread and dip your morsel in the wine." So she sat beside the reapers, and he passed to her roasted grain, and she ate until she was satisfied, and she had some left over. When she rose to glean, Boaz instructed his young men, saying, "Let her glean even among the sheaves, and do not reproach her. And also, pull out some of the bundles for her and leave it for her to glean, and don't rebuke her." 17. So she gleaned in the field until evening. Then she beat out what she had gleaned, and it was about an ephah of barley. She took it up, went into the city. Anybody remember how much that weighed, probably? Yeah, anywhere from 60 to 100 pounds. She slung it over her shoulder and carried it home to Naomi. And I remember telling you that this was just prior to Pentecost. So there were 7 weeks of harvest time. And if she gathered an ephah, if that was the average during those 7 weeks, then she gleaned enough for a year's worth of food. That's a lot of food, which explains the excitement of Naomi that we'll get to in just a moment. She took it up, verse 18, took it up and went into the city. Her mother-in-law saw what she had gleaned. She also brought out and gave her what food she had left over, and after being satisfied. And her mother-in-law said to her, "Where in the world have you been, and where did you get all of this? Blessed be the man who took notice of you." So she told her mother-in-law with whom she had worked and said, "The man's name with whom I work today is Boaz." Naomi said to her daughter-in-law, "May he be blessed by the Lord, whose kindness has not forsaken the living or the dead." Naomi also said to her, "Hey, this is a close relative of ours. He's one of our goels in Hebrew, one of our redeemers, a kinsman redeemer." And Ruth the Moabite said, "Well, besides, he said to me, 'You shall keep close by my young men until they have finished all my harvest.'" Naomi said to Ruth, her daughter-in-law, This is really good. This is good, my daughter, that you go out with his young men, lest in another field you be assaulted." So she kept close to the young women of Boaz, gleaning until the end of the barley and wheat harvest. And she lived with her mother-in-law. Let me just show you. So I have to turn the page to get to chapter 3. But chapter 3 deals with the threshing of all of the barley, of all the grain that they gathered. So there are several weeks that pass between chapter 2 and chapter 3. Just keep that in mind as we go through this. But I want to highlight a couple of things here. I didn't get to finish last week, so I'm going to kind of run through this kind of quickly. Just hang on. Notice that Ruth's simple faith in following after Naomi is now paying off. And it's God who's doing the paying. He's paying things off for her. Now, the climactic verse is when verse 19, where she names, where Naomi says, "Hey, I know who that is." Or where Ruth says his name is Boaz. That's the climactic verse. But before we get to that, notice that there is a glaring contrast between Naomi's attitude when she first got to Bethlehem and where she is now. Did y'all notice that? That's something that you ought to pick up in historical narrative as you read through them. that the author is not going to just underscore it for you, but you ought to pick up on how God has changed her from Mara, this bitter Naomi, to now she's like, oh my word, where did you get all this food? Everything's changed for her from bitterness to joy, from emptiness to fullness. And who's behind it all? Yeah, God is behind it all. Don't miss that point. I thought that would be a good place to stop. I think a point of application could be right there, that some of you perhaps are in bitter places. And if you are, hang in there. Remember, God is still God. He's still on the throne, and He takes people from emptiness to fullness, from bitterness to joy. God does it all. Okay, so just hang in there. And then the climax. This man is a close relative of ours, she says. He's one of our redeemers. In Israelite law, you've heard this probably before, so just let me explain it for those that are going to be listening to this, perhaps online. And that is, Israelite stated that whenever an Israelite passed away and he left behind land or wife, etc., that the nearest of kin would come and take care of all of his belongings to keep his name going, to keep his heritage going, etc., etc. And so this is why Naomi is so happy, because not only has Boaz blessed the living, meaning who? Naomi and Ruth, but he's also blessing the dead, meaning Elimelech and Mahlon and Chilion. So that's why she says the living and the dead. If the deceased family is in a crisis, this Goel or this Redeemer is to come to their rescue. Is that what Boaz is doing? Yeah, he's doing just what he's supposed to do. And Naomi says the unusual. This is why she says this unusual, that his kindness has not forsaken us. Okay, just wanted to bring that out to you and then show you some points of I guess, life application before we go to chapter 3. And here it is. For me, this chapter highlights over and over the providence of God at play in His people's lives. And I want to underscore that in the life of Boaz. So, seeing God's providence at work in the people around him, Boaz steps up and participates with God. That's important. What good would Boaz have been if he meets Ruth and he meets Naomi and he says to them, I see that you're in great need here. I can tell by looking at your clothes that you're destitute, you don't have much, and I can see that you're hungry as well. And what if Boaz said this? Let me just have prayer with you. And he offered a nice little prayer with wonderful words. It was so comforting, and said to them, Lord, I wish you would please meet the needs of these two ladies, and that you would bless them. And then he ended his prayer with amen and said, now have a good week. Would that be doing what God's called him to do? Do you know people that do that? Have you ever done that? No. That's in chapter 3 and 4. You got it. That's what he'll do. And we'll talk about that part of Boaz again. He's a man of integrity. Right. So what then could be my point? That when you see God's providence at work around you, participate. Yeah. But you've got to see it. I mean, when you see it and recognize what God's doing, like, you know, I mean, running into somebody at the store, and then again in 5 minutes you run into them again, and obviously there's something, there's a connection that's there. Think about what's going on. What is God doing in that moment? It may not be anything. It may not be a God moment. But at least watch for God's providence at work, and then participate in it. We learned in Experiencing God years ago when we did this study together that we are to watch where God's at work. And do y'all remember what else? And join Him. Excellent. God is always at work around us. Watch for it and then join Him. James says something similar. I read this in 2:15 through 17. James seems to say that to not participate when you see God's providence at play is to have dead faith, that you're just a hoax. You're not the real thing. When you see it, providence at work, and you refuse, you just say a nice little blessing over them and then tell them to move along their way, then James says you don't even have real faith. Faith must be accompanied by works. Let me just read that, unless somebody else wants to. James 2:15 through 17, somebody. Okay, don't want everybody to jump at once here. James 2. James says, if a brother or sister is poorly clothed and lacking in daily food, and one of you says to them, quote, go in peace, be warmed and be filled, unquote, without giving them the things they needed for their body, what good is that? So also faith itself does not, if it does not have works, is dead. So my point is, I watched Boaz not only just see that there was a problem and watched how God had brought them back, not just brought them back to Bethlehem, but brought them to his field. And not just his field, but he also is a cousin to Naomi. He sees all this going on, and so he participates. I think that's a wonderful point that we ought to remember. The second point I want to make comes by way of a question. And I touched on this last week. Why is it that the author keeps bringing up that Ruth is a Moabite? Over and over, he keeps bringing it up. I'll point it out to you. 2:2, 2:6, and 2:21. There's this mention of a Moabite, a Moabite, a Moabite. And I think for me, it was to remind me of Boaz's over-the-top loving kindness. Is Ruth entitled to God's blessings? She's outside of the covenant. So we need to think about this. Think about what are some ways that we might show loving kindness to people like Ruth. You know of any outsiders in our culture today? You know of anybody in the midst of racial war again, where we might show loving kindness to people who are not like us? Think about Ruth. How do we show loving kindness? Can you think of ways to show Christianity in this current culture with all the racial tensions? Let's just stop right there and tease that out for a moment. What are some ways that we could be Christian in a racially tensioned culture? Think about it for a moment. What are some ways? Just speak. We were at the fair this past Sunday night. By the way, Sunday night's a great night to go to the fair. Hardly anybody there. It was really good. So we're at the fair and we're standing in line and just two or three black ladies behind us, and we spoke to them, and one of the little boys had autism and another little boy. We just found out all kinds of stuff about them. We had a wonderful conversation with them. And for me, it was just a great way to break some barriers down and just communicate. And I think that's important. What are some other ways? Just speaking is good. Be human. Yeah. I mean, so does Boaz say to Ruth, really, you're not the same color as we are, and you don't look anything like us. And you don't dress like us, and you may just need to move on. He doesn't say that. He doesn't even restrict her from being in his field. He welcomes her in. Other ways that you can think of.
Mm.
Yeah. Well, I mean, there's a generation of people that live in our culture that are real confused about what Christianity is. And so it would be good just to, I mean, it's almost like we're oddities. We're different. And nobody knows how really to relate to us, that we're just a kind of a weird group. So it would help to communicate to people, to show them even nonverbal things. Anything else? You are right. Yeah. Well, just be thinking about that. I mean, we tend to, and why would I say that to this particular church? Why? We need diversity. And also think about where we are. We see the same people day in and day out, and we do the same thing over. It's good to step out of the rut every now and then and to show Christianity to people that don't know us. And yeah. Well, another reason, why else might the author be emphasizing that Ruth is an outsider to and new to the faith, if you will? Well, here's what I came up with, and you tell me if I'm right. I think one of the reasons that he might be showing us that Ruth is an outsider, that she's new to the faith, is to spur us on for when we fall into ruts, religious ruts and routines. What in the world do you think Anthony Wilson's teaching the church? 10-year-old Anthony Wilson, what do you think he could be teaching? Why would God send him here right now at this particular season of our church? Yeah, but what is it that Anthony Wilson has that the church needs? Y'all, God doesn't just send people here to be saved for just because. He puts particular people in the church for the needs of the church. Do y'all believe that? Now that's looking deeper into why God brings people to our church. Why would God have brought Tom Fitzgerald to be saved in his 70s? Tom Fitzgerald. Why did he bring him here to be saved? No, that's Bob. Tom Fitzgerald sits right here. He's a Paradise guy. Tall guy. John, why did he send him? You ought to see John's face on Tuesdays after he finishes with Tom Fitzgerald discipling him. He and Chad are discipling him. You ought to see his face. His face glows like he's been on Mount Sinai with God. I'm telling you, you hang around Tom Fitzgerald. If you've been a believer for more than 25 years, you need to hang around Tom Fitzgerald for about a week or so. He is so hungry. He wants to know everything he can. Why in the world would God have brought Al Atherton to be saved, 76 years old? Why in the world did he bring this guy here to First Baptist Church? Huh? To watch us, to help us see what it's supposed to look like once you're saved and how you're supposed to serve. That's why. Yeah. Why would God bring Abby McKenzie, who was baptized and saved about a month ago? Why would he bring young teenager Abby McKenzie? Here's why. She says to me, "Pastor, I've got a friend at school. She just lost her dad. How can I talk to her about Jesus?" When's the last time I had an adult at this church that's been a member here for more than 25 years come to me and say, "Hey, Pastor, how do I evangelize? How do I talk to somebody about Jesus?" That's why God brought Abby McKenzie. Why did God bring Rex Lee, 56 years old, to be saved in my study about a year ago now? To show us his dedication to the Lord. He should have been here tonight. I'm going to get on to him. But he's here every Wednesday that he can and every Sunday morning that he can. He's just like Tom Fitzgerald when I disciple him, starving to know more about the Bible. Y'all, there are people that God brings to our church. Why would God show us these things about Ruth, an outsider, and keep calling her a Moabite? To show the church what it looks like for someone to come to faith in Christ or to come faith in God, become a God follower, and the excitement and the zeal that's there so that we can learn to mimic that kind of stuff. Okay? That's enough of that. Anything you want to say about that? Oh, good point. To see what they have to go through to get there. I had someone tell me on the golf course just recently, Pastor, I visited so-and-so church before I came here. I went into the church and I went into a Sunday school class, and one of the members of the class leaned over and said, "Are you a member of the church?" And this person said, "No, I'm not." And the member said, "Then you can't be in this class." What people go through to become a follower of Christ and join a church.
It also is telling us you don't have to just be an Albanian from Alba.
Yeah.
We've got some from other states. We've got some from other, you know, big cities, little cities.
Yep, yep, yep.
And we all become one
thing. Yep. Mom was saved, by the way, gave me a really good testimony of that. I don't want to go too much with that, but anyway, she's a believer. That's good stuff.
Mm-hmm. My brother was visiting here from Houston. He was telling us the church he goes to that one of their leaders got up there and they were just bragging about what a friendly church they were and so on and so forth. And there was a lady sitting up close. She got up and walked to the pulpit uninvited.
Yeah. Have you been to a diverse church? Have you been to a church with all sorts of colors and creeds and languages? Have you been to one of those? Anybody? It's an experience you'll never forget. Absolute joy and bliss. I'm telling you, it's fantastic. Yeah. If you ever, when you go on vacation, visit churches, you guys. Visit a church and then, you know, learn what they do and what they do wrong and what they're doing right. That's important. Here we go. Yeah.
Real live. I mean, to me, some of it was too much.
Yeah.
You don't get out of 12 either, do you?
No.
They'll keep you for an hour.
No. I think we ended up leaving about 1.
That's what I said.
Yeah.
He said, if you think you're going to get to watch the football game, think again.
Yeah, that's good stuff. Okay, here we go. Chapter 3. Is that all? Anybody else want to add anything at all? Sam, I'm... Was it? Way out in left field? Yeah, you know, I preached a revival once in Cottonwood Falls, Kansas. And, oh, boy, it was different. It was just... I was depressed when I left. It was bad.
He wasn't?
Oh, well, I'm glad y'all are grounded enough that you picked up on that pretty quickly.
One of the couples that visited here Sunday, Kevin and I talked And they were very impressed with the church.
Good.
And they had heard a lot of good things. That's why they were here. They usually go to their son's church where he preaches. But he
was had a day off or something.
Had a day off or was somewhere else. But there was a couple from Tennessee. They do volunteer work in Tennessee.
Yeah, the Morrises, yeah. Okay, good. All right. So a few weeks go by, and now they have the harvest, and now it's time to go to the threshing floor with all of the wheat and all of the harvest, the crop. Notice there's a picture there for you of what a threshing floor looks like. Before we read about it, I just kind of wanted to show that to you. And I'll just show my hand here. I'm not sure what kind of animals those are, but anyway. Back in Bible days, they would use either, a horse, a donkey, cattle, ox, whatever. And they would walk on that. So they throw we'll get to it in a minute. But a threshing floor is up on a hilltop, and it's got to be up there by the wind. And I'll tell you why as we go through this in just a moment. But there's kind of what it looks like. They walk the animals on top of the grain to break it out of the shuck or the hull. What am I looking for? Y'all help me, the farmers? Yeah. Yeah, the chaff is what's left behind. And the chaff is what blows in the wind, and the kernels are left behind. Yeah. I've been in agriculture for all 40 years. Been a farmer for 40 years, and these things just slip my mind every now and then. Naomi, her mother-in-law, said to her, "My daughter, should I not seek rest for you that it may be well with you? Is not Boaz our relative with whose young women you were? See, he's winnowing barley tonight at the threshing floor. Wash, therefore, anoint yourself, and put on your cloak, and go down to the threshing floor, but don't make yourself known to the man until he has finished eating and drinking. When he lies down, observe the place where he lies, then go and uncover his feet and lie down, and he will tell you what to do." She said, "Yes, ma'am." Verse 6. So she went down to the threshing floor and did just as her mother-in-law had commanded her. When Boaz had eaten and drunk and his heart was merry, he went to lie down at the end of the heap of grain. Then she came softly and uncovered his feet and lay down. Doesn't say she laid down beside him. She just laid down. At midnight, the man was startled. He turned over. Behold, a woman lay at his feet. He said, "Who are you?" She answered, "I'm Ruth, your servant. Spread your wings over your servant, for you are a redeemer." He said, "May you be blessed by the Lord, my daughter. You have made this last kindness greater than the first, in that you have not gone after young men, whether poor or rich. Now, my daughter, don't fear. I will do for you all that you ask, for all my fellow townsmen know that you are a worthy woman. And now it's true, I am a redeemer." And this is what Margaret was referring to. "Yet there is a redeemer nearer than I. Remain tonight, and in the morning, if he will redeem you, good, let him do it. But if he's not willing to redeem you, then, as the Lord lives, I'll redeem you. Lie down until the morning." Okay, that's where I want to stop at verse 13, and just take you back through this. I'm a fan of the Puritans, and J.I. Packer wrote a great book called A Quest for Godliness, and it features the Puritans. A Quest for Godliness by J.I. Packer. If you'd like to buy it, it's a great book, and the Puritans had a passion for marriage and getting marriage right. This quote fits right here. Packer says, "The Puritan ethic of marriage..." I actually put it on your study guide. You see it? "The Puritan ethic of marriage was to look not for a partner whom you do love passionately at this moment, but rather for one whom you can steadily love as your best friend for life, and then proceed with God's help to do just that." I think there's a passion that's clearly developing between Ruth and Boaz. And I think it's going to be one that will last. We might ask, why is Boaz taking so long to pursue Ruth? That's a good question, y'all. What's the holdup? You know, you just want to say, come on, man. I mean, she's given you all the clues that she'd like to be close to you. And what's the holdup? The holdup comes in what she's wearing. Now, she's wearing the garb of a widow still. And Boaz is being a man of integrity, of honor and character, and he's respecting that. So up to this point, to chapter 3, she's had on this garb of a widow. That's why Naomi says, get that thing off. It's time to move on with your life, okay? So follow along with me here. I'll show you what I mean. Verse 3, notice, wash therefore, anoint yourself, and put on your cloak. So put on something different here, Ruth. Like I thought about like a widow today might keep wearing her wedding ring, you know, as a sign that she's not, she doesn't want to remarry, or, you know, or when she takes it off, it perhaps is the green light. I don't know. But this, for me, it was a good way to relate what Ruth is conveying non-verbally. So Boaz has picked up on these non-verbals that she's just not quite ready. Who is it that thinks that she needs to be ready? Yeah, her mother-in-law. Let's go, girl. Let's go now. Be thinking about this. And so Naomi comes up with a pretty good plan, I think. And 1 through 5, I call it a kind and careful plan. And here, if you want to take the study guide home with you, I'm just going to have a chance here to just to touch on it. But notice that I'm breaking it up in 3 different sections, and I am going to use alliteration because it just works. The plan is in 1 through 5. The proposal is in 6 through 9 that comes from Ruth by her actions, by her nonverbal actions, and then she just finally blurts it out. But she's the one asking him to marry her. You'll find that out as you read. That's the proposal in 3:6-9. And then finally, 10 through 13, the last little section we're covering, is the payoff. And I want you to be looking at these 4 extraordinary evidences of a godly man or a godly husband, about what he does for her and what he says about her. That's real important for you. To look through, I think it'll be helpful. So watch the plan. Let's look at the plan. And a proper way to introduce a plan is by giving a reason for the plan. And that's what Naomi does. She asks a couple of questions, 2 of them, I think, to be exact, and says to her, am I not your mother-in-law, and am I not out for your own best interest here? And the answer from Ruth is, well, of course you are. And so she says to her, that's why I want to find rest for you. So if you look rest up in a Hebrew dictionary, it just means security, provision, a home. It means all of those things. Now, those are pretty important things for a woman in Bible days. There are not a whole lot of Helen Reddys back in the Bible days, you know. Remember Helen Reddy? I'm woman, hear me roar song, yeah. Not a whole lot of those ladies back in Bible days. These ladies were dependent upon a man to help them, to provide for them, to protect them, and to treat them with honor and respect. This is exactly what Naomi wants for Ruth. And that's why she says, I want you to go find rest, and I want to help you. So here's the plan. Naomi tells her she wants her to find some rest, and by that, I just cleared that all up. I think here is, for me, a clear picture of what a covenant relationship looks like between 2 people. A covenant relationship, when you get into one of those, which is between you and the Lord, and between you and your wife or you and your husband, a covenant relationship looks out for the best interest of the other person. Okay, that's classic covenant language. Did God have you, your best interest in mind? When he sent Christ to Romans 5:8? Yes. This is God's very nature. So I think this is a good opportunity to say, this is what Naomi's doing for Ruth. She's showing us that God has a covenant relationship with her, and she wants now to extend this covenant kindness on Ruth. That God has extended it to her, she's extending. It's all about the best interest of the other person. Does that kind of look what your marriage looks like? I hope mine does. The best interest of the other one. All right. Here is how Ruth can find that rest. And here's where we probably will stop. But no, here's my translation of what she says to Ruth. Okay, you ready? I put it on your study guide. Get a bath. Get out of that widow's garb. Get a little perfume on the nape of your neck and get up there to the threshing floor. Okay? Now, y'all, all kinds of ink has been spilled on commentary pages trying to figure out what in the world is going on between Ruth and Boaz. I mean, is this a rated M for mature audiences only section? Maybe some of it. Maybe some of it, but y'all listen to this and then I'll stop, I promise. When you're looking at a passage like this and you're wondering how much sexual content is explicit here or is there any? I mean, we have to in our minds say, what in the world she's doing pulling the covers off of him? And what is this all about? Context, don't forget this. Context is king. If you teach Sunday school, you've got to know that. That is fundamental to Bible interpretation. Context is king. Is what so far what you've seen of Ruth, does it show her as a kind of sexually loose kind of gal? Not at all. Absolutely. Does it show Boaz as kind of a playboy? Not at all. So context has to be king. You've got to go back and see what have these characters shown me up to this point. That will help you interpret what is going on the threshing floor. I would say, I will say that I don't think he's drunk. Did he have an alcoholic beverage? Probably. But his heart is merry. He's relaxed. He's worked hard all day. The job's done, and now. Naomi says in all of her wisdom as an older lady, now's the time. His heart's in a good mood and he'll receive you. He'll know what you're doing when you do that. She doesn't lift the cover all the way up. That's another thing. People will say, oh yes, it's all the way up and she's exposed him and now he's wondering. No, have you ever woken up during the night and the sheets come untucked and your feet are hanging out? I hate that. What's it feel like? It's, y'all don't mind? I cannot stand it. Oh, I can't stand that. It wakes you up. That's the point, is that Naomi says, Ruth, go do this. It wakes him up. It kind of startles him. It's on a hilltop. The breeze is blowing. His feet are cold. It wakes him up. And then starts the conversation. We got to stop. I could just go on and on and on, but we'll stop right there. We'll pick it up. We'll come back. Integrity in a tight spot next week. No.
But she stayed at his feet.
She stayed at his feet. Oh, I agree. Yeah. I think the author, if it's Samuel, is careful to say that she didn't go up and lie down beside him and then uncover. That's reading way too much. Remember, context is... Yep, context is king. Okay. Father, thanks again for the reading through your book. Thank you for these characters who show us so many things we should be learning about ourselves and about our worship. Thank you for that. In Jesus' name we pray. Amen.